This talk, I'm going to give you 1 hour, the first hour for me, every week. And you don't have to do these in the same order, but you got to do them. The first hour for me is structure. Or, to put a word on it that you might be like, I don't know what you're talking about, organization. And I'm not talking about my sermon, the structure of my sermon. I'm not talking about the outline of my sermon. I'm talking about the organization of the text. And that then is going to be where I try to go every week. First thing, let's give it an hour. This session comes with a picture. This is an original. Okay, talk to the guy next to you. What is that picture? Now remember, some of my drawings are published, so don't laugh too hard. Go ahead. What is it? Tell the guy next to you. What is it? All right, what do you got? What do you got? Anybody? Somebody give me one. First guess, Lincoln? A woolly mammoth. He's right on it. It's close enough. It's a woolly mammoth. Anybody else got another word for it? An elephant, yeah, it kind of looks like an elephant, it could be, but it's not. It's a mastodon. That's a mastodon. Hey, let me get this right now, because I know you guys are going to like this. That's copyrighted. That's copyrighted. That's my picture for this session. Actually, it's a picture of Perry Mastodon. There was a judge in the suburbs of Chicago in 1963 who decided he wanted to put a little pond in his backyard. His name was Perry, Judge Perry. And so he got the backhoe, and the guys showed up, and they started digging around in his backyard and came across some skeletal bones. They had to halt the thing. I mean, one of the bones was massive. So this guy takes the bone over to a college in the next town and shows it to a couple of anthropology professors, and they take it down to Mr. Gulpin in the city of Chicago, who runs the Field Museum, and they say, "What is this?" And Mr. Gulpin looks at it. He goes, "Well, I've got a guess at it, but we need to get back to your field to uncover a few more bones." So the guy's pond, which was going to hold goldfish, is now on hold, and his whole property is roped off, poor Judge Perry, and it turns into an archaeological dig site. Over time, they find about 120 bones of this animal that normally would have about 180. Key point for you and me a little later, you don't need all the bones to know the shape of your text. But at any rate, they find all these things, and by the femur alone, they go, this thing was a mastodon. Now that thing, then, the college that was next door took, and then they recreated the other bones, and you can now go onto that college's campuses and to this day stand behind glass and watch Perry Mastodon turn around in circles. Half of them is all fleshed up again. The other half is all the skeletal structure that they found in the ground. That's the picture. What's the relationship to preaching? The best preachers are paleontologists. First. Now, you might not know what a paleontologist is. I actually have a member in my church who is studying to be a paleontologist. It's a weird congregation, but at any rate, a paleontologist would work in the hardened soil of the ancient world with the fossil record in an effort to find enough bones to determine the shape and emphasis of something whereby they could identify it, and in some places then, put flesh all back on it as though it were a living creature. If biblical exposition is what Dave Bissett said, if biblical exposition is happening when the shape and emphasis of my talk has been fully, rightfully, joyfully, Christocentrically submitted to the shape and emphasis of the text, then the first thing I've got to do every week is apprehend for myself that shape, structural, organizational elements of the original text. I've got no chance at being an expositor if I can't first apprehend for myself the shape of the text in front of me. So I'm a paleontologist now. Someone could ask you, if you get on a plane and you don't like witnessing because you've been talking to people about Jesus all week, and the guy says to you, what do you do for a living? Just say, I'm a paleontologist. They won't know what to do with it. They won't ask you any more questions. You can go back to your music. That's what I do. That's first hour for me. Now, it might take me longer than an hour, so don't hear me wrong. Sometimes this thing takes me 5-6 hours. Sometimes it takes me 30 minutes. But I at least give myself an hour to getting enough of it out there. I don't got to get it all. I don't need all the ligaments. I don't got to discover all the bones. I don't need all the connective tissue. But I want to be able to see the text I'm getting ready to preach in regard to its structural, elemental shape. And therefore, it's that shape which allows me to see the emphasis of what actually might be emerging. And it's only Monday or Tuesday. It's not Friday or Saturday. So I've got time to let this either be confirmed to me over the week or actually altered as I get near my preaching. So the first order of business, according to Mortimer Adler, when you're reading a book analytically, the first order of business is to understand that every book has a structure. I'd go further. Your preaching text within your book has an organizational structure, that the Holy Spirit has given you the ordering of your text in accordance with his own desire to reveal that which he has to say. And so if you just assume that for a moment, that every text, every rational unit of discourse that I'm going to preach probably has an organizational structure to it, that is something I need to see. Adler would say that you have to put on your X-ray eyes and you have to apprehend it for yourself. And if you don't apprehend it for yourself, you're not ready to preach. This is the downside. If you're not a paleontologist, you could be a preacher like this. No, this is not the preaching workshop thing. Okay, tell the guy next to you, what's that? It's a jellyfish. Tell the guy next to you, since you're also quick this morning, what do you know about the skeletal structure of a jellyfish? Tell the guy next to you, not me, tell the guy next to you. Yeah, he doesn't have one. And some of you preach like this because you weren't a paleontologist. So you get up in the pulpit and there's no sense of ever having apprehended the structure of the text, and therefore there's no sense of organizational logic or order to you. And you come across the pulpit like this, and you just kind of come in, and you go out, and there's always some old lady in the back that'll thank God for your ministry. But most of the people are going, I am absolutely clueless what he thought he was trying to get done today. Or you could be one of those guys that went to university and you studied, you know, literary analysis, or you went to seminary and you took Greek, Hebrew, and you studied under Piper, perhaps, one of his former interns right down here in front of me. And so you learned, you know, not only discourse analysis, but you learned sentence diagramming and arcing and all of that. I mean, you get structure. But you're another kind of aquatic preacher. Somebody give me the animal, not the animal, the bean. What are they? If you're in the water, what are you? Yeah, you're not a fish, but you're a crustacean. Tell the guy next to you what kind of crustacean a number of preachers are who have been trained for ministry by going to formal education. Go ahead. Just tell the guy next to you. By the way, all my drawings are in the modern art wing. They're not in the, you're what I call a crab cake preacher. You are so excited this week because this conjunction right here that joins this to this actually has a etymological heritage. And all of a sudden, you're preaching every structural element of the sermon, thinking you are a really good expositor. And most of us, we're like, wow, you really are a good preacher. You know a lot. I'm not having any seafood for lunch today. In other words, you begin to think that exposition is saying something about everything in the text. This is especially true in discourse. We're gonna hit this week. Expositional preaching requires that I see the shape and emphasis of the text and that I rightly submit my talk to the shape and emphasis of that which I've said. But expositional preaching is not having something to say about every bone, every structural elemental bone in your text. That's something else. So, you know, you can be all excited that you did 200 sermons on Romans, and I'll go home excited that I wasn't a member of your congregation. And I would say, whatever it is you were doing with the Bible was a lot of good things, but I don't think you were doing exposition. You were doing something else. You were apprehending everything and all the way through your text without ever understanding the relationship of what he was trying to do or what he was trying to say or how he went about saying it or to what end he was trying to say it. All of that is there. So I guess I lay those two ocean-like figures before you to come back to the fact that you want to be a paleontologist. You got to be a good paleontologist. And don't get wrapped up this week in your small group if you're like, you know, I got enough structure here to see the shape. If you got enough after an hour of preparation, great. Let it sit for a while. Go on to something else. So then, there's two things I think you've got to do that every paleontologist is required to do. Why don't you just tell the guy next to you, what two things must a paleontologist be aware of to do his work well? I'm not looking for a direct right answer, but just get your mind working. What does a paleontologist have to do well if he's going to be successful? All right? Somebody give me one. Just yell it out. Yeah, what do you got? All right, you got to know where the bodies are buried. No, you got to know the bones and the bodies. Yeah. You actually have to know. You actually have to distinguish between different kinds of bones. There are different elements in play here. Yep, absolutely correct. And that's going to matter when it comes into discourse. We're going to pick up your comment in just a minute. Somebody else, give me something else. How they connect together. How they actually work. And so that becomes a very important point, similar to what he's saying here. When I see the distinction of the bones in my text, I'm also importantly connecting how they actually are formed or related to one another. Somebody else? Got to know where you're digging. I'll put it this way. You've got to know the kind of soil you're in. I mean, you know, if you don't know where you're at, if you don't know if you're in Greenland trying to look at something or if you're over in, you know, doing a dig on out in the Holy Land, the soils themselves are not, they're going to indicate even what kinds of animals or life I might actually find, whether it's plant life or, I mean, you got to know the soil. What else do you got to know? What did Judge Perry, what would have been the first thing they talk to Judge Perry about in regard to getting after the bones in his backyard.
Did you have a permit?
Did you have a permit? Yeah. Did you have a permit? I like that. That's excellent. You have to know what tools would be appropriate. If you're dealing with a really intricate, fragile skeletal structure, you don't want to bring your backhoe in. So when I think about this in regard to preaching, the two things I need to be able to do well in my first hour, at least for me, I have to know what soil am I in and what tools are appropriate. There are three kinds of soil in the Bible. By that I mean there are three kinds of text type in which I'll be digging. Tell the guy next to you, what are the three soils of the scriptures, that is, the types of texts in which I will be putting to work my paleontological skills? Go for it. All right, somebody give me one. Somebody give me one. A text type in which preachers dig.
Discourse.
In fact, this week, that's the soil we're in because we're in the book of Ephesians. Somebody is saying something. Discourse, in a sense, they are speech writers. Now, you can have dialogue going on, but dialogue can often be embedded into a different kind of soil, and which is what? Did I hear something?
Narrative.
Yeah, well, okay, we'll get to the third one. Sorry, I missed that. No, you got it. I got no excuse. I just blew that. Those are them. Discourse, narrative, narrator. How did I get narrator? That's because I was all screwed up with what you had said. Narrative. Again, I was an athlete. All you needed was a 1.9 GPA to play. Man, it was beautiful. Those were the best days of my life. There was no advantage to going above the line. Like, why would you want a 3.7? I mean, we had guys on our team that had 3.7, but they weren't carrying more minutes than I was carrying. They'd put too much time on that thing to be good. You couldn't fall below 1.9, because if you fall below 1.9, you're not going at all. But at any rate, what I'm trying to say is I'm not a very good speller. That's all I'm trying to tell you. I'm not a very good speller. Discourse, narrative, and poetry, those are the soils in which you are going to spend your first hour. You need to identify next Sunday. You could probably already do it in your own mind. Knowing what you're going to preach next Sunday, you should be able to first understand, is it narrative, is it discourse, is it poetry? Put differently, am I preaching this week from a speechwriter, a storyteller, or a songwriter? And the reason I need to know the soil is why. What benefit is it to you to know the soil before you start digging? To know which tools are appropriate. Because if a guy's writing a speech, he organizes his material along the rules of the road that speechwriters work with. If he's writing a song, there are a different set of organizational things in play by which he puts his material together. If I'm in poetry, I am always wedding the images to the ideas, Psalm 1, the images of the tree that's firmly planted, bearing fruit, and the chaff. But the images of tree and chaff are related to the ideas of the righteous and the wicked, Psalm 23. I am in an agrarian culture, or I'm in the field, and then I'm also at a table. The idea, though, is that David, the king, is protected by the Lord in the midst of his wandering years, but also in regard to the establishment of his own kingdom. This kingdom, all of this is there in poetry. We're not in poetry this week. So to think about your structural organizational question in terms of images and ideas, you might get somewhere with it, but you're not going to get where you need to go quick enough to be a good sermon preparer. Put it narrative. We're not there this week, but if we had been doing Exodus this week, or 1 Samuel instead of Ephesians, you would be utilizing tools that story writers use. You'd be thinking about plot and setting and new setting and conflict and rising action and climax, because that's the way they utilize those tools to make sense. This week we're in discourse. So tell the guy next to you, what kind of tools are going to help you apprehend for yourself the organization of the material that's in front of you for next week? What tools will be best employed to get you in your preparation where you want to go in the book of Ephesians? Tell the guy next to you. All right, what do we got? What do we got?
Grammar.
And I was so bad at grammar in school. And as a result, I have more trouble in discourse than I do with poetry or narrative. Now, some of you this week, this is going to be this first step, the first question on your small group worksheet, it's going to be tough. But that's okay. You're going to be exposed to things that other guys at your room have more facility with. And you're going to look them in the eye at the break and go, how did you see that as clearly as you did? Because I just saw they gave me 16 verses. And I had no ability to know how to apprehend its shape, let alone its emphasis. See, so this is something, but grammar, for some of us, it's going to be like, this is my wheelhouse. Now, the problem is, most guys who went to seminaries, they were schooled primarily in the New Testament and almost exclusively in the epistles. Therefore, they might look really good in your small group. And if you feel kind of overwhelmed by them, just say this to yourself. Yeah, I'll see you next year when we do narrative. because maybe you have greater facility somewhere else. But we're going to learn from one another this week. Grammar is the big word. But now we got to get to the insight that this gentleman put forward in regard to, you got to know the different kinds of bones. What are the different elements that comprise grammar? Tell the guy next to you. Depends on the book you read. But you should at least be able to get four, maybe more. But what are the elements of grammar? Because grammar isn't going to get done for any of us. All right, I got four spots for words. So I'm just thinking first three rows or so will get somebody. The last three, those guys. So we'll hit four representative answers. You guys are going to have the toughest job because you've got to come up with four, the fourth. So the three easy ones are already going to be picked off. So we'll see if you can do it. What do you got? One element of grammar. Conjunctions. Conjunctions, just so you know, if you don't know, and I'm not assuming most of us know, you can Google it on your phone while we're looking, but these are things that join things. This would be like the words that actually, that's connective tissue between two things. Think of the word and. Think of the word but. You know, you got this, but this, that's a joint, that's ligament, that's tissue, connective tissue. And in discourse, it becomes a really fundamental element that you have to know how he's saying what he's saying. Somebody, the back half, give me a second one. Verbs, in distinction from nouns, now you guys can't use nouns anymore. Verbs, it kind of this the they're carrying the action. They're the doing. Dave is teaching. What's the verb? Is that which he is doing? Yeah, that's probably a pretty tough one for us. But you actually, it's great because it shows you how difficult all this is. Verbs, in a sense, are nouns are the people, the places, and the things. It could be, you know, the object in this sense. Well, verbs are the action. Back half. Third.
Adjectives.
Okay. You think I'm bad. Now you know why Dave Bissett wrote so terribly. I bet he's a really bad speller too. When he comes back, we'll have to ask him. Because that's, you know, that's a really great way when you can't spell, you just kind of, An adjective is modifying what? A noun. Now, you could have given us another word, an adverb, which is modifying a verb. Now you already get to see, wow, this is tough. This is why preaching from epistles is tough. Okay, front section, give me another one. Prepositions. What are prepositions? Say that again.
Anywhere a mouse can go.
Explain that to us. Keep going. I love it. There are a ton of them, right? And I've never heard that phrase before, but I like it. Anywhere a mouse can go is a preposition. You know, just the other day, this is a true story. Speaking of mice, sorry. We just renovated this building, 1916. I caught 6 mice in glue traps last week. So tomorrow we have an abatement guy going out there to get the rest of them. But the guy that runs our facilities, he was kind of afraid of the mice. So I caught that little mouse. And you know, the problem with the glue trap is he's still breathing, right? So the guy that's running the facilities, he's like, I'm not getting that little squirmy guy. And I go, this is easy. I just took a paper towel, put it down there. I said, look, you got to be humane. Take him out. But anywhere that mouse can go in my church building, anywhere he can go in my building is an adjective. And he's been in stuff, on stuff, around stuff, through stuff, under stuff, all of that. He's dead now. Let me give you a few other things that are going to be important for this week. You have to be able to somehow identify a main clause in grammar. I'm not too good at this, but I think, and this is a tough thing for me, but I think a main clause is kind of the noun, well, Peter Kroll could help me, connected to the verb, or the subject connected to the verb, correct? Let me give you an example that we saw yesterday in Ephesians 1, verse 3, is it? Something about, blessed be God. And then the whole sentence goes for 14 verses. What's the main clause of 14 verses? I'm lost because this thing's got like a million things going on in it. But the main clause is the kind of thing in your text next Sunday in discourse that can kind of stand on its own. That's the way I try to do it. So even if I don't know all the parts of speech, I'm asking myself, in these 16 verses that these crazy Simeon Trust people have asked me to preach on, what is the one thing that stands independently on its own that doesn't have to lean on anything else to be here? And that's kind of what helps me. And in that big long run, and we'll see how we do in our small groups, right? I mean, this will actually be a fun either reinforcing exercise or do we now see how we might be better at this exercise? The first 14 verses, the main clause is Blessed be God. May God be blessed. Everything else finds its relationship to that. It would be hard to preach that, any text in discourse, without at least making a good stab at what you think is the main clause. Because the shape of this whole thing has an emphasis, and the emphasis is usually, I would say, inherently going to be connected to the main clause. So this is a very important piece, and also I find it to be one of the most taxing things in this first hour of my study. Well, let's put this into work. We've got half our time. Well, we've got 18 minutes now to work this stuff. Go to 1 Peter 5, and let's put a few of these tools in our hands. I want to put a couple of tools in your hands just to see how you do as you talk with one guy next to you. Somebody read in your groups of two or three at the most, chapter 5, verses 1 to 4. And the first tool I want to put in your hand is a main clause. Read it. There's a lot that's said. But what do you think is the one thing that's said that can stand on its own, that doesn't require anything else, and that everything else is somehow related to? Chapter 5, 1 to 4, 1 Peter. Tool in your hand, you're a paleontologist on Tuesday morning, main clause, go for it. For those of you who are athletes, for all the athletes in the world, you're now looking for a subject and a verb that actually kind of sits there and everything else has to find its way in relationship to it. All right, anybody? Anybody just want... go out on a limb. Shepherd God's flock. That's the one I came up with too. Now, but it's Tuesday morning, so don't get too frightened. But actually, I think if you spent the week doing stuff, in your first hour, you might go, I'm gonna run with that. It's only my first hour. It's provisional. I'm gonna give it my best shot. I think there's a lot of subject in here. There's a lot of verbs in here. But I actually think the one that might actually hold this thing is shepherd the flock. It seems like most things have to find their way back to that. Let me put another tool in your hand. Conjunctions. Conjunctions are words that connect. In particular, I'll give you a little help. Let's try for the conjunction. Well, which conjunction, those of you who are already ahead on this, which conjunction would you be like, if I was teaching today, I would have gave them this one? We got a lot of options. But let's go with but, just for a moment. But it also shows you you're already having to prioritize stuff. Main clause to a conjunction. But is joining two things together, joining two bones together. Read it again and see how that fits within the text as far as the organization or the shape, the structural shape of this passage. Look for it, identify it, and comment on it to the man next to you. All right, what do you got? So where do you see it? Which verse do you see it first? Two. It's there how often? Twice. And the third time is following in verse 3. Interesting. Now I'm back over here. It's Tuesday morning. I have a main clause, I think, in verses 1 and 2a, which is shepherd the flock. I have another unit of thought then that is underneath this, and it's these three not but clauses. That's kind of the body of this. And then how would you make sense then of verse 4? Talk to the guy next to you. What is verse 4 doing in relationship to the main clause and the things he wants to say concerning how one does that? Just tell the guy next to you. How is verse 4 functioning? Because see, this is actually sermon prep. I'm actually sitting in my office, not looking at any books. I'm just asking myself, how is verse 4 functioning? In other words, how are these parts related to one another? What's the relationship of verse 4 to the main clause and to what he has to say concerning how that main clause is carried out? Anybody? Okay, now you're already making some really cool observations on a Tuesday morning. You're like, oh, this body, the body of this text is how. He's concerned with how you go about doing this. And then you're saying what?
Why?
Okay, so then you're actually saying, okay, what do I need to do? Verse 1 and 2a is the what. Verses 2b to 3 is the how. Verse 4, you're saying, is the why. To put it differently, verse 1 is the exhortation, right? Isn't that, so I exhort you. Verses 2b through 3 is the execution of that exhortation. And verse 4 could be called what? Expectation and or encouragement to the main clause. The expectation, you know, interestingly, this whole text, if you put it even out a little differently, there's something going on in the very beginning and the very end where there's the repetition of the word about Christ's future appearing. That's a structural bone laying there. It's also down there in verse 4. His appearing comes back again. So back to the tone or the aroma of the text, whatever it is to shepherd the flock, my text wants me to be thinking of shepherding the flock within the confines of his second appearing, therefore the word expectation, but also the word encouragement down here. I'm supposed to shepherd the flock. I got to do it in this way, and there's an encouragement all of a sudden, it's now Monday morning. It's now 10 o'clock. Your staff meeting is getting ready to start. You walk out of your office, or your, in Raymond's case, his family living room, which is in his church building. You bump into someone in the church, and they say, what are we doing this week, Pastor? You go, well, I just got an hour underway, man. Well, yeah, what are you doing? Well, I think we're going to be talking about shepherding the flock this week. We're going to center down on shepherding the flock. At least that's what I'm thinking now. And wow, it needs to be done in a particular way and not in a particular way. But you know, I'm really excited because I actually think even after just a little time this morning, it's going to be a great encouragement to us. It's going to lay down some expectations for us as a church family. And like all of a sudden, you're way ahead. You haven't done anything with a sermon outline. You haven't done any of that. All you've done is realize that when you want to be a preacher, you must become a paleontologist. You have to. It gets more difficult in a book like Ephesians than that simple text right there. And we gave you more verses to handle than you want. We are stylistically complex on purpose so that in a room of seven guys, you're going to be listening to one another's working sense and capacity to do this. And by the end of the week, wow, you're going to do really amazing things. The other thing I would say back to this, these things that are here that will help you in epistles is the purpose clauses, the purpose statements. It's a part of grammar. It's an element. It's a bone. And it normally comes with a couple of English words. What would a purpose statement normally be enfolded into in the text?
So that.
Yep, so that. That's a grammatical element. In other words, whatever he's been saying, however he went about saying it, he had a purpose for saying it. And that is really got to be driving sermonic work. Because it's one thing just to say everything that this text says, but not actually know what's being said. And a lot of preaching in discourse does that. You know what I call that? Tell the guy next to you, what does Helm call that? That's Mr. Jones preaching. You're up there doing your thing, and the congregation's out there singing Bob Dylan. Something is happening here, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? You're saying all this stuff for 40 minutes, and they're going, this is a cultural moment where the people that are in charge are clueless as to what actually is going on. You don't want to be a jellyfish. You don't want to be a crab cake. You don't want to be Mr. Jones. And you're not going to be Mr. Jones if you can make improvement in this area. Let's take a look at another one. Get out of 1 Peter for a second. We're just trying to put these tools in your hands. 2 Timothy, to stay with discourse, 2 Timothy 2, 8 to 13. Main clause. Ready? Go. Any idea? Any idea? Remember Jesus Christ, okay? So it's Monday morning. I don't have to be right yet. But they told me to spend an hour. And at the end of my hour, I sat on Remember Jesus Christ. It seems to me it stands alone. Doesn't need anything else in the text to be there. Doing its own thing. But I could begin to think about how everything else in the text is related to it. What's interesting is, then I start looking at verbs. And I start looking at even something else with verbs, tense. And then I begin to see, remember Jesus Christ, as he's risen from the dead, he's looking back upon the completed work of Christ, for which I am now suffering. He begins to move towards something in the present. But then by the time I get to the little poem in the end, he will do these things. There's something in the future. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking, my word, remember Jesus Christ in the past. What about Jesus? His resurrection and his rule. Why would I need to remember that? Because it's going to make sense of my present, which is anything but resurrection and rule. But given my present, I've got a future encouragement, because if he shared in that, if he was raised from the dead and he reigns, it's nice to know that I will reign and I will be raised from the dead. And all of a sudden, the structural elements of the text are there. So, this week, a lot of work on question number one, structure. You may not have any background in this at all. You don't owe anyone in your group an apology. You just tell them, Helm's 1.9, I'm 1.8. And then you say, let's look. Let's look together, main clause. Let's pay attention to verb. Let's pay attention to tense. Let's pay attention to prepositions. Let's look at conjunctions. Let's see how simply we can begin to put out the parts of these texts and then demonstrate their relationship to one another so that the shape and emphasis of my talk would be mirroring in a really healthy way the shape and emphasis of the biblical text.